What are some of the things that you find most exciting about being a geologist? I've always been very interested in minerals. I've always been very interested in crystals. And I think a common factor for both is the fact that they just occur naturally. I mean, to me, it's really amazing that natural processes deep in the earth and at the crust of the earth cause minerals to grow, whether that's literally growing a mineral crystal out of a hot fluid or literally growing a mineral crystal out of molten rock or magma, when there are other ways that crystals grow in nature. But to find these beautifully shaped crystals that were naturally formed and not man-made is really interesting and exciting to me. I've always enjoyed collecting rocks and minerals ever since I was in grade school. I've always been lucky. I've been lucky. What it was my grandfather worked in mining and quarrying for years. So when my siblings would visit grandparents, my brother and sister would stay with my grandmother, and my grandfather and I'd go off to the mine, and I got to climb around and kind of just collect rocks and minerals. And really, one of the first things was finding these little pockets with quartz crystals and these limestones or marbles of Dutchess County, New York. And that really got me hooked on crystals and such. So, I mean, early on that was interest. Now, what I find really exciting and what's fun is really studying the effects of hot water or steam on really hot fluids, which are known as hydrothermal, high temperature hydrothermal fluids, and how, one, they play a very important role in escaping from magma and driving explosive volcanic eruptions. So it's the escape of gases and their expansion. Just like hot water or steam drives a turbine, hot water or steam coming out of a magma can blow magma apart and cause explosive eruption. Sometimes these hot fluids or hydrothermal fluids can come out of magma, escape from magma, and not cause an eruption. They can escape passively. And subsequent to their escape, they can actually dissolve metals like gold or copper, lead, zinc, iron, silver. I mean, there's a whole host of metals that will dissolve in these high-temperature fluids. And then they're transported. They actually move because these fluids expand. They, their volume increases, their density decreases, and they want to actually they tend to ascend towards the surface of the earth. So they'll find fractures and cracks and move up. But when they finally enter cooler rocks, their temperature, the hot fluid's temperature changes, it drops or decreases, and the fluid's ability to dissolve metals decreases. So then you form a vein, or you form some kind of metal deposit. So it's really exciting and fascinating to me how hot water, with some other things added, with some carbon dioxide or some sulfur or some chlorine or some fluorine, other volatiles, like this, how they work together, one, to either cause explosive eruptions of volcanoes, or two, form metal deposits, or three, they can just form really beautiful crystals that may not have any economic value, but it's just amazing what hot water does in and about the surface and the crust of our Earth. How did I first become interested in geology? Well, I think I mentioned that was my grandfather had worked in quarrying for years, and he actually set me up with my first rock and mineral collection and helped me make a little box to put them in, and he actually made my very first rock hammer for me in his metal shop. And then we would just go collecting together, and then he would actually take me out to mineral shows once in a while, and we would purchase, you know, rare samples from other parts of the United States or other parts of the world that would have been difficult to get to. And that really was really early on. I had no intentions necessarily early on of becoming a geologist. I just started taking classes in college and enjoyed it, and it just kind of grew from there. So it's not like I had a plan to do this all along. Early scientific influences, one really was my grandfather. Two were probably teachers and classes I took. Three, I used to probably spend far more time reading than playing sports as a kid. And in fact, I spent a lot of time in the library in summers. And I'm embarrassed to admit that I actually like dinosaurs really. So dinosaurs kind of superseded volcanoes and things early on. But then that kind of changed my interest kind of. I mean, I've always enjoyed collecting fossils, and I did that all the way through high school. I'm learning a little bit of biology and a little bit of evolution that way. But really, more and more over time, just became rocks and how they're so diverse, how they change as a function of if a rock or a mineral is buried to a mile or several miles depth inside the earth by the deposition of other materials on top of it, whether that's sediments or other rocks. The pressure and temperature go up, and these rocks and minerals can change. They metamorphose or change. That's really fascinating, too. In fact, down in the Hall of Planet Earth, we have these huge garnets that are bigger than basketballs, and they're formed by this very process of little tiny quantities of water shooting around in really hot rocks under these metamorphic conditions and making bunches of dispersed teeny garnets all collect together in these huge garnets. It's really fascinating. Can you talk about a meaningful experience you had related to your work or travels? I can honestly say probably one of the most, I mean, being present at my kid's birth was incredibly exciting. But in terms of real life experiences, probably, and I won't rank it, but one of the other most exciting experiences in my life was in about 1997 or 1998, I was working with Ed Matey and other colleagues in this department in the Hall of Planet Earth, and we'd gone to Hawaii, and Kilauea is the active volcano on the Big Island of Hawaii, and Pu'u'o'o is kind of a satellite volcanic crater, a small one, that's linked to the magma that feeds Kilauea, and it was flowing. Magma was flowing out of Pu'u'o'o, and I walked out there with some colleagues, and we were looking for potential samples, scouting out sites for video to include in the exhibit, and we also made a cast of some of the Pohoihoi lava flows there. And we suddenly realized there were these brand new flows that had kind of crusted over on top, and underneath some of these little crusted over dark black portions, because basalt or basaltic magma crystallizes black, there was this bright orange-red, you know, fresh magma there. And you could be 8 or 10 feet away, and you could feel the heat. The heat was incredibly intense. And then someone had brought along a little coffee can, and we put water in it, and you could take a rock hammer and kind of scoop up the lava. And it was amazing to me, having, you know, got a fireplace at home, that kind of thing. The same distance away from a fire, if you're a foot or so away from this lava, I mean, you literally had to have your skin completely covered. It would start to singe your skin because the heat is, you know, the temperatures are so much higher. It was like really intense. But that was really, truly exciting, was to be walking around on this stuff. And in fact, on another venture, we went there with, and I won't mention his name, but a former volcanologist for the United States Geological Survey. And he was leading us on a trek in the same location. And he went to step across this brand new lava flow. His boot squished into it, and his boot bottom caught on fire. But just for a second, he tamped it out. And what we did was we actually went up upstream, so to speak, of this fresh new lava flow, maybe 20 or 30 feet, and we walked across this thing. And we realized afterwards that it was kind of dumb, because if someone tripped and fallen, put your hand down, you would have really totally singed your hand. But that was exciting. So first time around lava, passively flowing, nice, safe lava flows in Hawaii, that was like really, really meaningful. Exhibits here I've worked on at the museum. I was co-curator. Ed Matey was senior curator for the Gottesman Hall of Planet Earth, and that was just a fantastic project. As you know, it really deals with Earth process, how the Earth works. And we were really fortunate that at the time we were working on this in the mid to late 90s, prior to its opening in 1999, there were sufficient funds to travel all over the world and collect these big, beautiful specimens. I think with the dinosaur folks who did their hauls, they had lots of big, huge specimens already in storage in various locations. So we didn't have these big, gorgeous pieces, so we were really lucky to get to go out and travel around the world. So met a lot of colleagues and worked with some really interesting people that were very, very generous with their time to help us on that exhibit. I did the audio tour tape that goes for the Gottesman Hall of Planet Earth. Otherwise, I worked on the gold, the temporary exhibition on gold, and that's been a lot of fun. And it's turned out, I think, it's been a well-received exhibit, and it's really interesting. And I think it does a great job of kind of treating gold from historical to cultural to geological to materials properties and kind of ties it all together. And then just current people's views on gold and its use in commerce and industry, and as a symbol of human achievement and purity. Let's see. What are some of my current research interests or projects? Right in front of us here is a big, huge map of Augustine Volcano up on the wall. I've been working with a colleague here, our department's volcanologist, Charles Mandeville. He's the senior research scientist here. He and I were there in August of this year. Augustine's erupted historically seven times, and the most recent time was in January, February, March of this year. And in fact, we were very lucky in August of this year, 4 or 5 months after the eruptions kind of calmed down, to spend a week and a half with Alaskan Volcano Observatory geologists and volcanologists on site, collecting samples, getting flown around by helicopter, collecting brand new materials. And in fact, I'm currently working a talk that I've got to give on the day after tomorrow in San Francisco. So current project, in a larger sense, it's volcanoes. It's, again, hot gases, water, and carbon dioxide, and sulfur and chlorine, primarily, and how they dissolve in the molten portion of a magma, the molten rock or melt, how they come out of those or exsolve or undissolve out of those melts, and then what they do afterwards. I mean, the pressure that they can generate can force the magma apart, form big bubbles, can make a pumice or a gassy kind of glassy, gassy volcanic rock known as pumice that will float, or it can actually cause, again, these very explosive catastrophic eruptions. So we're doing research at Augustine Volcano. It's part of the Aleutian Chain in Alaska. I'm working with colleagues at the University of Naples. I have been for about 10 years now on Mount Vesuvius. And so what we do, one, we try to measure the concentrations of gases and things trapped in some of these natural samples. And at the same time, in my laboratory here at the museum, it's an experimental petrology laboratory, we can actually take crushed samples from these or any other volcano and then seal them up in a little gold capsule or platinum capsule along with water and carbon dioxide and sulfur and chlorine, and then seal it up and then actually melt them at controlled pressure temperature conditions. So we can actually simulate in these little capsules that are probably about the size of the end of your pinky, we can actually simulate in the lab molten rock with steam and gas in it at real pressures and temperatures equivalent to what the magma would be at that's feeding Augustine Volcano in Alaska or Mount Vesuvius in Italy or any of these other volcanoes around the face of our planet. So we, one, work with natural samples, and then two, we try to replicate those conditions at known pressure, because when we do the experiments, we know exactly the pressure and temperature we're at, and then we can measure the compositions of the gases and the melt at the end of the experiment and compare that to the natural materials to try to better understand or calibrate what the magma is doing in the real systems, right? The magma that feeds Augustine, the magma that feeds Vesuvius before either an explosive eruption or maybe one of these passive eruptions where just lava flows down the side of the volcano. At the same time, I've been also working with gold and other mineralized rocks, and a lot of them are volcanic. It turns out around the face of our planet, around the face of the Earth, there's this very strong association of metal deposits and volcanic rocks. And the important thing is that, again, the gases, these hot gases, steam, water, carbon dioxide, and others that come out of magmas can dissolve metals and transport and concentrate them into fractures and veins and make deposits of metals or concentrations of metals at surface. So also doing some work on that too. It's real materials, and part of our, I'm the mineral deposits curator here, and so I'm fortunate enough to get to travel to mines and collect samples to enhance our research collections. With regard to the gold exhibit, what is my favorite interesting fact about gold? I think it's kind of a long answer. Gold has this incredibly unusual, remarkable combination of physical and chemical properties. And it might be a mouthful, it might be a little esoteric, but I think we're all familiar with a lot of these when we think about it. One, gold has this fantastic, beautiful color and luster. In fact, gold is the only naturally colored, gold is the only yellow naturally colored metal. Gold is a native metal. That means it can appear pure, it can occur pure or nearly pure in gold deposits at the surface of the Earth, and that could be in a fracture or a vein or just some nugget sitting in some stream or riverbed. So gold has this beautiful color and luster. It can occur relatively pure, just naturally straight out of the ground, straight out of a deposit. It's very, very dense. It's almost twice as dense as lead, and that plays a very important role in its concentration in what are known as placer or surface deposits, where, say, in a moving river or stream, moving water moves fast. It carries minerals, and they erode and tumble against each other, rocks and minerals in the stream bed. But the lighter materials, the more common materials, just erode and transport away much more quickly than the gold because it's so dense. It's also relatively impervious to corrosion or oxidation. Gold won't dissolve in cold water at the surface of the temperature. Again, as mentioned before, hot water will dissolve metals, but cold water at the surface really doesn't dissolve gold. So that a gold nugget could sit theoretically in a stream or a riverbed for hundreds or thousands of years, and it'll get tumbled and moved around, but it's not going to break down too much. It's not going to dissolve. It's not going to tarnish and change colors. It's going to sit there and look just like the day it was formed. It's a beautiful gold color. And then also, gold is the most malleable of metals, naturally occurring metals, which means it can be readily shaped and hammered. I mean, 1 ounce of gold, and that would be equivalent to about 2 U.S. quarters. The volume of 1 ounce of gold would be, if you had 2 little U.S. quarters stacked on top of each other, that would be about 1 ounce of gold. That can be hammered out to 100 square feet by a professional, a single sheet, 100 square feet. Likewise, that same amount of gold, the 1 ounce, can be drawn out into a wire 50 miles in length because gold is extremely ductile. The malleability issue is very important because if we go back to the idea of a nugget or a flake of gold in a stream or riverbed, as it's getting tumbled, its sharp edges are kind of getting rounded off, but it really isn't losing mass. I mean, it tends to stay the same mass. It just tends to kind of reshape a little bit. Whereas other rocks and minerals break down to smaller and smaller particles, the gold doesn't tend to do that because it's so malleable and so soft, just really forgiving. You know, it's really friendly that way, that it can be. shifted and moved and eroded. And again, one, because it doesn't dissolve or tarnish. Two, it's very dense. And three, because it's malleable. It plays a very important role in streams and riverbeds, certain portions of those streams and riverbeds. Gold concentrates on the floor of the stream or the riverbed and forms these deposits, known as placer deposits. And they've been very, very important, one, in finding gold at the surface of the earth, and then two, in producing a lot of the gold that's been mined. There's only one important point about gold. What would you want that to be? Well, I mean, to be totally frank, about 78-80% of all gold is used in jewelry. Much modern mining of gold. We human beings crank out or produce about 2,600 metric tons of gold a year. A lot of the deposits that we mine, not all of them, but a lot of them, primarily in the U.S. and the Republic of South Africa, but in other countries, we mine these very, very low-grade deposits, meaning they're kind of economically viable if the miners move massive amounts of rock to extract the little bits of gold in it. So this means we either make huge open-pit quarries, open-pit mines at the surface of the earth, or we put large holes underground. So we're moving lots and lots of rock. There are environmental consequences for that. And the irony is, I mean, gold is used in jewelry, and jewelry is beautiful, but gold really truly isn't one of the metals that... It's not as important to modern societies as, say, iron is for making steel. Aluminum is for building aircraft or for car engines. I mean, gold is important, jewelry is important, but to me I find it ironic that it has these environmental consequences, but at the same time, in a way, it's a material of, you know, it's of less strategic need to societies. So to me that's kind of interesting. And then if I had any advice to give to a young person interested in becoming a geologist, you know, actually, I think if I can broaden that question, if I had some advice to offer to a young person entering earth science as opposed to geology, I mean, there's just been some fascinating expansions of our field, and largely because of the knowledge in our field. For example, like climatology, understanding climate change on the planet, brings in folks that are experiencing the weather, but it also largely involves earth sciences. And now there's just incredible amounts of information we're learning because whether one believes human beings are responsible or not, the surface of the planet is warming up. It may be a natural consequence. I tend to believe it's because human beings emit a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, and that should tend to warm the atmosphere, which is taking place. So there are these dramatic changes taking place. Sea level is going to rise. Ice in the poles and in glacial regions of large mountain belts is melting like crazy. So the oceans are going to rise. There's no doubt about that. So it's very important to understand what the consequences of this are going to be. But a big part of this is trying to understand climate change in the past by looking at the rock record, looking at the ice core records. People actually drill out huge ice cores now and count out individual layers, one for each year, and then study their chemistry. And there's some amazing chemistry that can be measured from these little tiny quantities of water, trapped water, frozen water, ice, and the ice cores, say from Greenland in the northern regions or from Antarctica in the southern regions.
We have one in the hall, right?
Yes, we do. Well, we have a replica. We actually have a replica of ice cores in the hall, got us in the hall, planet Earth. There's a lot of information that goes with it. So climate change is really, really key. We're learning more about more short-term changes like El Nino, La Nina cycles, and its impact on, you know, our weather here, but more importantly, on crop production and the lifestyles of folks in some third world countries around the world. It has these huge effects. There's a lot to be learned about that. There's a lot currently being learned. Over the last decade, our water resources have become kind of under threat. Lots and lots of people. Hydrology, or the study of the water balance on the surface of our planet, has been very important. It's continuing to be important. And then just still, we need lots of metals. There are more and more people. China and India are suddenly consuming huge quantities of metals. Their societies are growing, which is fine. We had our turn, and now it's their turn. And they're starting to have a huge demand for metals and hydrocarbons, petroleum. So there's going to be a lot more need for geologists in the future that can go out and look for metals and look for nonmetals and look for coal, oil, and natural gas and things like that. So there's a lot of demand coming up in the future. So in earth science, broadly speaking, not just geology, but earth science largely, there's climatology, hydrology, mineral resources. And then still, I mean, there are these basic effects of earthquakes or seismology and volcanoes on life. And they impact, they take a lot of lives. I mean, it's been estimated the volcanoes may have taken, unfortunately, more than 1 million lives in record, well, in history, I should say, human lives, and that earthquake events may have taken as many as twice that many lives, and we still yet cannot accurately predict volcanic eruptions or earthquake activity. So there's important needs there for earth scientists. So I would recommend going into earth science.
I noticed the list on your board there of the Vesuvius eruptions. There hasn't been any since 44?
No, it was the end of World War II. In fact, what was kind of cool was we had an air base. Italy had surrendered at that point, right? So we're still fighting the Germans. And what was neat was, well, what was interesting was, we had an air base there, and there was that eruption in 1944 actually covered a lot of the bombers. I mean, there's some pictures. I've got a book around here someplace. Pictures of the soldiers having to, like, shovel and sweep the ash off the top of the airplanes because it was not a good thing. They hadn't moved their planes in time. But so we've looked at probably 10 or 12 different eruptions, going back as far as 25,000 years and up to the 1944 eruption.
Is it showing signs that it'll erupt again, or?
Well, you know, not really. They measure the gases coming out, and most of the gases coming out are just kind of steam, and that's probably just hot rainwater that percolates down into the rocks, gets heated up, because the rocks are still quite warm from the last eruption, and it just gives off steam. But so they measure the gases. One can look for swelling of the volcano. One monitors, you know, they monitor its shaking or seismicity, earthquake activity. And there's not been a lot of that lately. What's interesting is there are kind of two groups in Italy, and the one I've kind of just inadvertently kind of tied with, been working with, looking at cyclicity, how frequently major eruptions are, the group I'm with doesn't seem to think that there's an impending eruption just based on cyclic behavior. The other group says there may well be. What's interesting is, and I guess it's a good idea, there are somewhere between 2 and 3 million people living in and around the slopes of Mount Vesuvius and Naples and surrounding areas. A lot of folks have started to build and move up the slopes of the volcano. And that was one of the remarks about how Vesuvius had obliterated Pompeii, or buried, I should say, Pompeii and Herculaneum back in 79 AD, that the folks just hadn't learned that they were living next to a volcano. Well, we know now that they're living next to a volcano, and they're starting to build up on it. So there are these issues of trying to evacuate, trying to control growth, and, you know, building homes and things like that, and then along the slopes of the volcano. So there are bigger issues to deal with. But no, but anyway, sorry, long answer. Yeah. 1944 was the last record.
Fascinating. It seems like there's about 7 per century until the 1900s, and then there was only 2.
Well, it's funny, because what it is, there were 18 little cycles between 1631 and 1944. So it was like 18 little cycles, never every 50 to 100 years, or whatever that is, 34 years. The problem is, the farther back you go back in time for any kind of rock record, the less detailed it is. The older they are, the more they could have been eroded or buried or changed by metamorphism or something like that.
Right.
But we've got major eruptions. There are 7 of them right in here. These are what are known as the Plinian eruptions after Pliny the Younger. You actually did the very first written description of a volcanic eruption that survived. So there are these major eruptions, and those are the ones that people look at for cyclicity, whether they're every 500 years or every 1,000 or 2,000 years. But the last real kind of pretty big one was in 1631. And all the other ones since 1631, these 18 cycles have been relatively small, really. I mean, you know, they've seriously impacted people and lives and homes and businesses, but it wasn't these huge catastrophic eruptions that just kind of dump so much ash they bury everything. So it will happen again. It's not an extinct volcano, so it's just a matter of time.
And then how true is that scenario in that movie, The Day After Tomorrow, with the ice? I think that was the title. But the global warming actually makes the Earth become cold and freeze over, and, you know, I think they had New York under ice.
Oh! Is this one that came out about 2 years ago, and it was like really, 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 really cold?
Yes.
Well, the whole premise on, because I watched that movie, the whole premise on what set that off is silly and goofy. I mean, what's really kind of neat as an aside, and I'll get to your question about the volcanism. Mm-hmm. What's neat is, and this really gets into the climatology issues, we have these humongous oceans that sit on the surface of our planet, and there's all that water sitting there. And it turns out that it takes a tremendous amount of energy to change the temperature of water 1 degree Celsius. So at the bottom of the oceans, the water is actually just a few degrees above freezing. It's really, really cold, but it's not frozen, obviously. And at surface, it's at kind of air temperature, surface air temperature, depending on the weather. To freeze the surface of the planet over, it would take incredible... the planet would have to lose tremendous amounts of energy because the oceans are just sitting there waiting to give. I mean, they basically they tend to buffer. I mean, it's like anytime you live near a coast, the temperature is more moderate because the oceans there help moderate the swings in temperature, whether it's overly hot or overly cold. So if you think of that on a planetary scale, it was really goofy that in whatever it was, a week or 2 weeks or something, some other planet was going to... I mean, to lose that much heat that quickly, that I just can't conceive of a way of doing that. I mean, if I could be honest, if you could suddenly pull the Earth away from the sun, if you could do that, I mean, it would stay... It would stay warm for a while because of all that heat from the oceans coming off. We wouldn't have sunlight, obviously, but it would have all that heat. So that would tend to resist that kind of thing. Well, there is the idea with huge volcanic eruptions. It's not the emission of the ash in the atmosphere. It's actually the sulfur dioxide. The sulfur reacts with water to make sulfuric acid. So it has little teeny, teeny droplets. I mean, these things are kind of almost microscopic. But they'll disperse around the atmosphere. And in fact, what was neat, there was an eruption of a volcano in Mexico called El Chichon in the early 80s, something like 1983, but the early 80s. And they use satellites to monitor this cloud. And when the volcano erupts really explosively, it can push the stuff out of the troposphere, the lowest portion of the atmosphere, but into the stratosphere. And the significance of that is the stratosphere, there's no weather. So stuff that's put up there stays a long time because it's above the clouds, so the clouds can't wash the atmosphere out as quickly. So they could monitor. It took roughly a month or so for this cloud to circle around the planet and come back to Mexico, because this was kind of equatorial regions. And within another month or two of that, it actually spread around the entire planet.
Wow.
And so these things, you know, that was a relatively small eruption. That sulfur dioxide that converts to sulfuric acid can really reflect a lot of sunlight. I mean, one of the big deals is going to be like the Yellowstone type eruption.
Right. I mean,
these big things that are just beyond the scale of anything we've ever experienced.
I've seen that on Discovery or something.
That's for real. I mean, it's the function of when it'll happen. But the one in Yellowstone, that's, you know, it's every 600,000 years, and there are three that have happened, and, like, it's been 600,000 years since the last one. So it doesn't mean we're due next year, but if the system is still behaving the same, you know, probably in the next 50 to 100,000 years at least, it probably, it's likely that it could go again. And when these things go off, it's like the equivalent of a bunch of Mount Vesuvius's all kind of going off all at the same time. And they don't shut down after a couple of days. They may go on for weeks or months. Just continuously pump all this stuff down. So this would be really catastrophic. This would be really bad news.
So that does make the surface of the Earth really hotter because of the... It's holding in heat like a greenhouse or because...
Well, what, you know, what it should do, I mean, what is that sulfuric acid... Yes, it's giving off greenhouse gases. But what it's going to do is it's going to pump all the sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere. That's going to reflect sunlight, and then there's less solar heating of the atmosphere.
It's colder.
And the surface of the planet will cool off. Yeah, like it could cool off significantly. I mean, after Mount Pinatubo erupted in the early 90s, at least for the southern hemisphere, it was measured that there was a, you know, half 0.4 degree or half a degree decrease in temperatures for a couple of years after that. And that was a fairly small eruption. That was not a huge eruption. It had a big impact on people in the Philippines, but globally it was not one of these huge eruptions. So these big ones could be really catastrophic for quite some time.
Okay. That was very interesting.